military veterans, and active duty service members. You could become a certified cyber warrior with just 12 weeks of training at My Computer Career. Cybersecurity specialists are in high demand, and IT pros with these skills often enjoy abundant opportunity and a great lifestyle. Protect our people, liberty, and treasured institutions from cyber threats. SkillBridge and other VA benefits are available to those who qualify. Learn more at mycomputercareer.edu/CWP. That's mycomputercareer.edu/CWP.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm so glad we're back together again. I just want to do a little housekeeping before we start. If you haven't had a chance to rate or review the show, please do. A 5-star rating or a good review from you guys means everything. So please, if you can, go ahead and do that. Also, tonight's episode, I want to let you know, it's the second to last episode of season 2. We have one more brand new episode coming up in 2 weeks. And then we're going to take a few weeks off before coming back with season 3 on April 25th. Now, you'll notice that April 25th is a Friday, and that's going to be our new release date. But you don't really have to do anything different. The episodes will drop into your feed on Fridays now, but you can listen to them whenever you usually do. And of course, please tell a friend if you're enjoying the podcast. There's still a lot of people out there who don't even know about the podcast, who have no idea it even exists. And I really want to get it out there to anyone who might enjoy it. So please let your friends know. The more listeners we have, the longer I can keep doing this. And also, thank you. In the last episode, I said, check in about the live shows and where you are. And if you can come and see me, and it sounds like you can, sounds like Indianapolis has got some fans. They've reached out. So I'm going to see if I can get something going there. Dallas is on my list now. And there's some places sort of around Washington, D.C., Baltimore, that area, sort of in between the two. Which I'm going to try to get to. But all the information on show dates, when and where I'm going to be and how, that's all going to get passed on to you relentlessly as soon as we get our travel plans figured out. All this is probably going to start in June, so we've got a little bit of time, but get ready because I am hitting the road. All right, enough of all that. Let's get started with this week's episode. Here we go. Investigating Mediums by Julie Beischel, PhD. I personally know two psychic mediums. Both of them are women, and as far as I can tell, both of them are communicating with the spirits of the dead. I knew them both before they became mediums. One of them began developing her psychic abilities after visiting a medium herself. The other had mediumship thrust upon her, you might say. Just after she gave birth to her first child, spirits began appearing in her home night after night, literally demanding that she contact their still living relatives and deliver personal messages to them. She describes it as the most terrifying thing she's ever endured. This onslaught from the other world happened just 4 years ago, and the best part? She kept a detailed, real-time journal, writing down everything that happened, sometimes minutes after it happened. In an effort to make the whole thing stop, she visited a psychic medium who eventually helped her learn how to control the contacts. They are ongoing, but now, for the most part, she controls the on-off switch. These women are both wives and mothers. They are married to friends of mine and are friends of mine in their own right. I know them. They are both highly functioning adults and professionals in their fields. I know they're not crazy. I know they're not lying. I know they're not faking. But what they're doing and how they're doing it, I haven't a clue. They both currently give free readings on a referral, word-of-mouth basis. But they've been doing it long enough, with great success according to those who visit them, that they've both been tempted to charge for their services, but they don't. They admit they're as surprised by their abilities as anyone. Talking to them reminds me of talking to people who do improv. It's real, it's scary, And even when you're the one doing it, you're not entirely sure how. Writing can feel that way too sometimes. Well, that's nice for you, Richard, you say. It sounds like you have some friends and you trust them, but I don't know these people. I'd sure feel a lot more inclined to believe you if there was any scientific evidence at all to back up these outrageous claims of theirs. After all, hasn't any legitimate scientist ever figured out a way to effectively investigate mediums? As it turns out, yes. In Investigating Mediums, the Winbridge Institute, 2015, Julie Beischel, PhD, does just that. Dr. Beischel received her doctorate in pharmacology and toxicology with a minor in microbiology and immunology, and you'll notice none of those ologies began with parapsych. Her plan was to make a bundle in the pharmaceutical industry, but instead she ended up applying her vast knowledge of science to investigate mediums, and she hasn't made a dime. And if that doesn't prove her sincerity, nothing will. Look, do I wish she'd spent 20 years making a personal fortune developing an even more powerful version of Viagra, and then do the medium research without any need for grants and donations? Sure. But in this crazy business of studying the supernatural, you learn to take whatever you can get. And what we get from Dr. Beischel is not only a lot, it's wholly unique. No one in the history of parapsychology has ever done what she's done. The experiment designed by Dr. Beischel is not about proving the existence of life after death or the survival of individual consciousness. Her hypothesis, stated in the form of a question, is simply, quote, "Are the statements a medium makes about the dead specific and accurate?" There are five areas that are most often pointed to as the, quote, "reasons mediums are faking it." Those areas are, 1, fraud, getting information about the deceased person before the reading. 2, cold reading, which is drawing clues about the deceased person from the sitter during the reading. 3, experimenter cueing, which would be the medium drawing information from the sitter with a variety of questions designed to, quote, "pave a pathway for the medium to travel." 4, general statements. These are statements from the medium so general they could apply to almost anyone. And finally, and most importantly, 5, rater bias. What is rater bias? Well, some people, in their desire to believe in the process of mediumship, will tend to find or focus on perceived hits and forget about or ignore the misses. Personal aside, this, of course, works conversely with sitters who consider themselves amateur debunkers and are looking to confirm their deeply held belief that all mediums are charlatans. They will tend to focus on the misses and explain away the hits. When Dr. Beischel created her experiment to test mediums, she designed it to account for these five areas. In her experiment, the mediums know nothing about the deceased person they are trying to contact. All they are given to focus on is a first name. And they are given that first name at the time of the reading, so no Google search or private investigator or personal research is possible. To account for cold reading, the medium will never meet, see, speak with, or come into contact with the sitters in any way whatsoever. The sessions are conducted by phone, by the experimenters, not the sitters. You can't draw clues from jewelry, clothing, accents, age, or attitude if the person isn't there and you have no idea who they are. Same for experimenter cueing. The experimenter is only allowed to ask 6 pre-approved questions. The questions are these. 1, what did the discarnate, or dead person if you prefer, look like in their physical life? 2, describe the personality of the discarnate. 3, what were the discarnate's hobbies or activities? How did they spend their time? 4, what was the discarnate's specific cause of death? 5, does the discarnate have any comments, questions, requests, or messages for the sitter? And 6, is there anything else you can tell me about this person? You might think the questions themselves are vague and unspecific, but to account for rater bias, each sitter, meaning the person going to the medium and hoping to talk to dead Uncle Joe, is provided with the results of 2 different sittings with 2 different discarnates, only one of which is the person they were hoping to contact. The answers to the questions are broken down into lists of numbered items, almost like dispassionate bullet points, you know, a red hair, the image of a pool table, the person was a big talker, or the feeling of pain in the legs. These lists are sent to the sitter, who then scores them in terms of the accuracy of each individual item on the list. The sitter then also gives an overall global rating of accuracy of each list, and finally, which reading of the 2 they believe refers to the person they were hoping to contact. You've heard of double-blind tests? This test involves 5 levels of blinding, with 3 experimenters blinded to the portions of the test outside their own personal purview. So, what were the results of the experiment? Well, we'll get to that in a moment. But before we do, maybe now is a good time to define exactly what a medium is and how they differ from a psychic. A medium is a person who can connect you with the dead. Through a mediumship reading, you should be able to communicate with the spirit of loved ones who have passed on. I picture it as a room with 3 people: a living sitter, a ghost person, and a medium in between the 2 who can see both and help translate messages back and forth. A psychic is a person who uses their, I'm going to use the word intuition, to access information about you, your past, present, and future. They may also access spirit guides or a universal source of information to provide you with advice and guidance about your life. Since communicating with the dead is considered a psychic ability, there's a saying, all mediums are psychic, but not all psychics are mediums. My experience has been that most do both, but that mediumship is by far the more difficult and emotionally draining process. Dr. Beischel's research backs this up. The mediums she has studied self-report that they, quote, take on and experience the emotions involved in the relationship between the sitter and their deceased loved one. And it's not always just love. Feelings such as grief, loss, anger, remorse, fear, and regret are very common. They also report experiencing the physical pain related to the spirit's specific cause of death. Chest pain is associated with heart attacks. Sharp darts of pain in the head indicate stroke or aneurysm. Even explosions of pain throughout the body indicate gunshot wounds. But the physical pain is nothing compared to the emotional trauma of being assaulted or even invaded by a malevolent spirit. And this can happen too. Aggressive, violent, angry, abusive people die and become aggressive, violent, angry, abusive ghosts. Sometimes they want to come through to apologize or make amends, but they don't know how. But sometimes they're still just fucking assholes. And this is why every medium I've ever heard of, including the ones Dr. Beischel worked with, practice what you might call safe sex mediumship. Each session begins with a prayer inviting in only benevolent spirits, or at least those who know how to behave themselves. And spirit guides are often invoked as gatekeepers, or as Dr. Beischel puts it, spirit bouncers, who keep out the ruffians and the ne'er-do-wells. Once the ground rules are established, a medium will open themselves up for business. They often describe it literally as, quote, punching in, or turning on the open sign. This process is most important because of its implied corollary, punching out, locking up, and going home. Mediums have to set boundaries, they say, or they will be bombarded by spirits continually. Many report being approached by spirits during their off hours, and they have various ways of dealing with this. Some will briefly engage, ask what the spirit wants, note it, and then disengage. This usually works. One medium in the book describes how she sees the deceased throughout the day, usually in public places, the supermarket, on busy street corners, at Starbucks. They stand quietly and stare at her from a distance, telepathically, quote, asking permission to communicate. This, of course, sounds terrifying. But the medium in this case simply responds with a telepathic talk to the hand and continues running her errands. So let's say you're visiting a medium for a reading and they've said their prayers and they are now open for business. What happens next? What is an actual session with a medium really like? Well, I can tell you about mine. I've had two sessions with psychic mediums. Neither were the friends I spoke about. This was long before I knew them. The mediums I visited were both complete strangers to me, and I was not in a state of personal loss when I had my sessions. I entered each reading like I would a magic show. I wanted to be enthralled and amazed, but I also wanted to see if I could figure it out. I will tell you now that neither session was hugely evidential in terms of specific verifiable information. I never got my grandmother's social security number. But both were successful in different ways. One made me feel much better about my life, and one made me feel much, much worse. Medium number one. I remember being really excited when the reading started and trying to maintain my attitude of open skepticism. And to be clear, what follows is not just my memories of the event, which took place back in May of 2000. The medium recorded the session and gave me the tape when I left, and I'm referring to that tape as I write this. And by the way, can we talk about what a baller move this is? By listening to the tape later, it would be pretty easy to discover the points where she went fishing for information or where I might have inadvertently revealed details that she used later on. I can tell you, as far as this session was concerned, none of that happened. For what it's worth, I have since learned that providing a tape of the session is common practice with many mediums. Okay, so the first section of the reading involved a lot of my dead relatives fighting to come through, but there was a lot of confusion about the specific personalities and whether they were on my mother's side or my father's side. For a while, my grandmother on my mom's side was coming through out of concern for my mom and her health. There was a lot of talk about my mom's eyes, the color of her eyes, possible problems with her eyes. But outside of needing reading glasses, my mom had no particular eye issues. Then my grandmother talked about my mom's cheekbones, how high they were, more than her sister's, and what a lovely face she had with these high cheekbones. But why? Why is she telling me about my mom's cheekbones? It's not important. It wasn't her main feature. It doesn't confirm anything for me. And so, for a spirit who apparently had to fight to get through, why is she spending all her time reflecting on my mother's cheekbones? That said, yes, my mother's cheekbones were higher and more prominent than those of her two sisters. We then move on to how my grandmother died. Now, this is a very popular topic of conversation for spirits when they come through. I've never been clear on why. Maybe it's that same impulse that we seem to have while we're alive to talk about, you know, how bad the traffic was when we arrive somewhere. Anyway, my grandmother was well into her 90s when she died from various complications of old age. The medium asked if my grandmother had trouble breathing at the end. At the end? Yeah, at the end she had a lot of trouble breathing. In fact, she stopped. After a while, my grandmother ceded the mic to a man who seemed to be an older brother of my dad, an uncle who died before I was born. This would pretty much have to be my Uncle William, or Willie as he was called. He seemed concerned with hair. Either he lost his hair or my dad was going to lose his hair. But either way, this uncle that I never knew is crossing the threshold of life and death to complain about going bald. The medium says, You'd be surprised how often this comes up with men. Then she says the most clearly inaccurate statement of the entire session. Quote, "Your father's been rereading a lot of books lately, a lot of old books." Now, if my father prided himself on one thing, it was being borderline illiterate. In fact, for years, my dad insisted he'd only ever read one book for pleasure in his entire life. It was about baseball legend Lou Gehrig, and it was written before he was ironically stricken with Lou Gehrig's disease. The book must have been terrible because, according to my dad, he never went down that dark road again. This uncle, who I never knew, thinks I should get a dog. At the time, I had three. He thinks I should get out into the country more, be near water. He says my front yard is bigger than my backyard. Well, that much was true. According to Uncle Willie, I was told I would soon be writing about British history, a drama about actual historical figures. Never happened, still hasn't. I was told I would form a creative partnership with a tall, skinny, dark-haired man, possibly named Edward. Never happened. In fact, while I know a few tall, skinny men, none of them are dark-haired. And the skinny, dark-haired men I know aren't tall. And I don't know anyone named Edward. We drift away from dead relatives now, and the medium asks me, "Is your business sense about what you do severely lacking?" She's asking this, apparently, on behalf of my spirit guides. She tells me I have three of them. They're standing behind me. Apparently, they are always standing behind me. They're back there right now. And no, this doesn't creep me out. Why would it? Why would it creep me out to know that I have three ghosts standing behind me at all times? But I'll give them this much. This turns out to be the most interesting and accurate part of the reading. Quote, "You're too sensitive to handle the business end of your business," they say. "You want to please people too much, and you don't play hardball very well. You'd much rather be with your head in the clouds." The medium tells me I have a, quote, "hard-headed spirit guide who is looking out for you in that area." I remember wondering if this spirit was working with my agent, and if so, how are they splitting the commission? The other two spirits, I'm told, were there to help facilitate my writing and creativity. I was told that my creativity was cyclical, not linear. It would come over me in waves and then withdraw. They even used the metaphor of a menstrual cycle to indicate that it was both perfectly natural and totally out of my control. This isn't what I wanted to hear. My career was just beginning. And so much was already out of my control. Even the quality of my writing was not truly under my control. The only thing I could control was the pace of my writing. I grew up at a time when the number one piece of advice I heard about writing was that I had to write every day. A real writer writes every single day. But I never did. I still don't. So there's always been a hectoring voice in my head telling me that this was my major weakness, and the reason why I'm not more successful. So it was interesting hearing the spirits tell me that no matter how hard I fight it, the cyclical nature of my creativity is non-negotiable. It's something I should accept and adapt to. Looking back 24 years later, the spirit guides were and are totally correct. Short bursts of creative inspiration followed by months of what I have come to know as my hibernation periods. But these cycles haven't always corresponded to my jobs. Early in my career, when I was off cycle but on a job, I see now that I depended on the help of others to get me through. Other writers who would meet with me for breakfast or lunch or all-day work sessions to help keep me on track. Or even development executives and producers who were more than happy when I brought them into my creative process. They thought I was being generous when really it was they who carried me through the dark times. I still haven't quite gotten used to the idea of my creativity being cyclical, but what it has led me to is a sincere interest in helping other writers with their process when I can. Then the spirits weirdly start in on my, quote, lovemaking, telling me I need to focus on it more seriously. This surprised me. As far as I was concerned, when it came to sex, I was as serious as a heart attack. The medium said she saw the image of high heels and said I needed to explore my feminine side. I know this sounds like a joke, but it isn't. I have it on tape. I didn't know spirits took such an interest in our sex lives, but out of all their observations, this extremely inappropriate invasion into my private bedroom activities is by far my favorite. The spirits now weigh in on my physical appearance. You're not much of an athlete, are you? You know what? Why don't you back it off, spirit guides? I don't remember seeing you at the gym. I mean, Jesus, first I'm a crap businessman, then I'm lousy in bed because I'm not wearing high heels or something, and now this? These are my spirit guides, the ones that are supposed to like me. The medium clarifies this point. It's not so much that they like me, it's that they're assigned to me, like punishment. Maybe this is their hell. Either way, they're right. At the time, I wasn't much of an athlete. But since then, I've sculpted my body into the work of art that now stands before you. They talk about how this time around, meaning this physical incarnation, this life, is about me being in touch with my physical body, learning how to be in a body. This is all spot on. As a child, I was intimidated by sports and was not naturally athletic. I wasn't picked last for teams. I was banned from the very idea of recess. While the other kids played kickball, I would walk long circles around the outer playground with Gary Takeuchi and Mark Upshaw, talking about cartoons like The Funky Phantom or Goober and the Ghost Chasers. Point is, I was never comfortable with any kind of physical movement, and not just sports, anything. Using tools, doing arts and crafts, building models, anything involving working with my hands. I've never changed a tire, fixed a faucet, or lifted the hood of my car for any other reason than to signal to someone else that my car is broken down and I needed help. I've always lived in my head, reading, writing, talking. I loved acting in high school. For me, the challenge was always what to do with my body on stage while I was talking. I'd stand there crossing and uncrossing my arms and shifting my weight from hip to hip and pawing at my face. It's like I was doing the world's worst Macarena. I had trouble with props. I couldn't pick up a glass without dropping it. I'd have to guide it to my mouth with both hands just to make contact with my lips. I couldn't operate a doorknob. If I finally did get a door open, I couldn't step through it without tripping or slamming my shoulder into the doorway. My spirit guides had apparently been to some of my high school plays and hadn't quite gotten over it. They urged me to do whatever I could do to connect myself with the physical world. Even getting a massage, they said, would be a worthwhile start. I agreed to try it, but mostly because it involved my favorite thing, lying naked and motionless in a dark room while someone else does all the work. The session ended and I felt good. I want to be clear that I think my medium was genuine. I don't think she was cold reading me or doing a lot of fishing. She still works and has a ton of great reviews online, and I know people who have had extremely successful, accurate readings with her. I just think that for whatever reason, my session with her didn't exactly hit the bullseye. There was enough generally accurate information about my life and my creative work that I didn't feel the reading was a total bust. Plus, at the time, a lot of the predictions about my future were still up in the air. Tall, skinny Edward could have shown up at any moment. It's only with 24 years between me and the reading that I see how little ever truly hit the mark. Now, let's check in with Julie Beischel. How did her mediums do when she put them through the paces of her quintuple blind experiment? Well, as it turns out, they did pretty great. Out of a total of 21 readings, 16 sitters chose their own target reading as the one they felt was intended for them. This may not sound impressive, but pure chance would put that number much closer to 50%. This was 76, statistically very significant. The result of Dr. Beischel's experiment supported the initial hypothesis. Certain mediums can report accurate and specific information about discarnates with no prior knowledge about the sitters or discarnates, without any feedback during the reading, and without using fraud or deception. Now, granted, it was a limited study, only 21 readings. I would have preferred more, but this kind of research is expensive and time-consuming. I'm also curious about the sitter scoring. In other words, are the kinds of information provided scored differently? Here's what I'm talking about. If one of the details about the discarnate is brown hair, that could be scored as accurate by the sitter. But what about a detail like played the tuba or died of rabies? Those would simply be marked as accurate too, but shouldn't that sort of incredibly idiosyncratic information be given more weight? In any case, Dr. Beischel seems to be well on her way to proving something. But what exactly? She isn't sure, because nothing about this experiment conclusively demonstrates proof of life after death. All it proves is that the medium is receiving accurate information from somewhere. But is it from the surviving souls of the dead? Or is it plucked from a hypothetical psychic reservoir that contains all information since the beginning of time? Or is it a form of super ESP? The super ESP theory has been around for a long time, at least since the original Society for Psychical Research began doing their studies in the 1880s. In the super ESP theory, the medium might be receiving their information from the mind of the sitter, or the experimenter, or someone else, or from the future, or from aliens, just not necessarily the actual souls of actual dead people. Dr. Beischel correctly states that this is an unsolvable problem. But as long as she had a bunch of mediums sitting around on the clock, as it were, she decided to try something no one else has ever done. She asked the mediums what they thought they were doing and where they thought they were getting their information from. They all reported that when it came to mediumship, they felt they were receiving messages from the dead. So, Julie designed an experiment to test this. Like her other experiment, it was conducted entirely by phone and involved only one piece of information for the medium to focus on, a first name. The same six questions about the dead person's appearance, personality, and behavior were asked. The only difference? Not all of the names belonged to dead people. Some were the names of alive people. So the mediums were asked to answer all the normal questions and then state whether they felt the person was alive or dead. In an astounding 83% of the cases, the mediums were able to discern whether or not the target was living or dead. And they made their determination based on how the information about the person came to them. When information came from a dead person, the mediums reported, quote, the presence of a sign that contact had been made. These signs included sounds like a bell ringing or an alarm buzzing, lights flashing, or feelings of an intense burst of heat or physical vibrations. The mediums also reported experiencing the feeling of, quote, encountering an autonomous, independent communicator who could surprise or frighten the medium with their presence and who could display opinions or feelings with which the medium did not agree. They also reported experiencing the emotions of the dead targets, while only being aware of the emotions of the living targets. One medium described the difference as, a psychic reading is like reading a book. A mediumship reading is like seeing a play. And a striking number of mediums report the sensation of receiving information from the dead as being like, quote, seeing a movie, but one in which every sense is engaged, sight, hearing, taste, smell, and touch. It is not dry information being reported. It is emotional and immersive. Now, I want to give you a very different story of a reading. This is the reading that dismantled my brain brick by crumbling brick and replaced it with a box of spiders. This is the dark side of a one-on-one meeting with a psychic medium. And this is why I stopped doing it. Medium number two. The second time I had a private reading with a medium, it was 2.5 years after the first one. In those intervening 2.5 years, everything in my life had changed. I had separated from my wife and gotten divorced. I was now living alone in a house in Pasadena. The Mothman prophecies had been made and came out and not been a hit. But I had written the pilot for Miracles. It was filmed and had been picked up to series. At the time of the reading, I was in the middle of producing season 1. I went into this reading wide open and came out feeling like I'd been punched in the face. My reaction was so extreme. It was like I'd gone to the doctor for a simple checkup and then was handed a terminal diagnosis. Now again, with 24 years of perspective, I realize how emotionally fragile I was then. Even though my life had technically improved in so many ways, I was still experiencing deep emotional trauma from my divorce. I was in a very vulnerable place psychologically. But for some reason, I truly believed the reading was going to be great, triumphant even. One where my spirit guides would stand up and applaud me for all the progress I had made. I expected a lifetime achievement award. Instead, I got roasted. From the session, quote, "The younger one has taken the divorce harder than the older one, but the older one is being affected too. I know you want to believe that you've got everything handled. You're very progressive with the divorce and the joint custody, but there are glitches here. And I want you to be especially aware and watch the children." Okay, this was early in the session, and I'm not panicking, not yet. Obviously, it's not great to hear that the kids are struggling with the divorce, but it's not like this possibility had never occurred to me. I'm not thrilled with the guides for taking a shot at me for being progressive, but okay, whatever. Good advice. Keep an eye on the kids, fine. From the session, quote, "I may be completely off the wall, please forgive me for this, but I wouldn't be surprised if you got back with your wife. I wouldn't be surprised if you guys end up living together. And I know that sounds completely off the wall. I'm not sure what that's all about. And I'm not saying that it's necessarily the best thing, but it might be circumstances that cause this to happen. Now I'm panicking. The hardest thing I've ever done in my life was leave my marriage. Now somehow the guides are saying I'll be moving back in with her. This seems beyond insane. But because I'm me and I want this process to be real and useful, I'm giving it all more credence than perhaps it deserves. The part that really gets me is the quote, 'It might be circumstances that cause this to happen.' All I can think is that something is going to happen to one of my kids. One of them will become seriously ill or die. And somehow because of that, my ex-wife and I will decide that we need to be in the same house with the remaining child for their sake. Every single thing about this terrifies me." From the session, "I really wish I could sit here and say the next 2 years are going to be a breeze for you, Richard. I really do. But that's just not what I'm getting." These words build upon my fear and dread. Things are going to be bad for the next 2 years. I've just gotten through the hardest 2 years of my life, and now it's going to get worse. The only bright spot in my life, the only sustaining force, has been my career, working on season 1 of Miracles and hoping against hope that it's successful. So that's where the guides aim their guns next. From the session, "It looks like you're headed toward a crisis of faith because people around you who you thought you could trust will turn out to be people you can't trust because they have their own agenda." Okay, some context. In November of 2002, like I said, I was in the middle of producing the first season of Miracles. I had never worked in television, much less co-run a show. My co-showrunner was David Greenwald. He was coming off running Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel with Joss Whedon. Because I'd never worked in television, the practice common to this day is to pair a new show creator with someone who has show running experience and hope that the partnership works out. There are horror stories about newbies getting paired up with cynical, backstabbing assholes who pretend to be friendly and helpful, but are really just angling to have the creator fired from the show so they can take over and claim all the power and credit for themselves. Because this was so common, many people told me that it was going to happen to me and that I needed to brace myself against this possibility by being openly hostile to whoever I was partnered with to prove I was tough and not to be fucked with. Along those lines, someone actually told me that on the first day of production on Miracles, I should walk down to the set and fire someone, loud and in front of everybody. After that, they said, everyone will be terrified of you. To me, that advice sounded insane. And my natural instinct was the opposite. Be welcoming and non-threatening. No one does their best work in an atmosphere of fear, at least I don't. If no one feels threatened, no one will act aggressively against me. That was my philosophy, so that's how I proceeded. With this in mind, it won't be hard for you to understand that I never for a moment saw David Greenwalt as my enemy, competition, or possible betrayer. From the very beginning of our partnership, we saw eye to eye on what the show was and what the episodes should be. We made decisions that would strengthen our partnership. For instance, we co-wrote the first two episodes. We discussed switching off, but then decided that since those episodes would be written first before production started, it would be a great opportunity for us to work together while we discovered what the show was. Then later, when we started working with the other writers on staff, we'd be able to think and speak with one voice as we conveyed to them what the show was. This turned out to be a really good idea, and it worked out exactly as we'd hoped. Since we'd started working together that past June, David and I laughed more and had more heart-to-heart talks than I would have thought humanly possible. But by the time November rolled around, we had both been put through the ringer by the studio and network and the process. And I can only speak for myself, at least, when I say that my nerves were shot, my patience was thin, and I was starting to get a little frazzled. From the session. There may be people in your sphere who tell you they have your best interests at heart, but they don't. Don't listen to what people say. Listen to what they don't say. Now I start to get seriously paranoid. Have I been lying to myself about my partnership with David? Is he the person who doesn't have my best interests at heart? Who's he on the phone with when he drives home to his mansion? The studio? The network? The cast? Is he talking to them about me? Is he the person the spirits think might be undermining me? All of these thoughts start filling up the dark, flooding sub-basement of my mind. The worst part is, the spirits aren't giving me any names. So instead of suspecting someone, I suspect everyone. If it's not David, it's got to be Skeet Ulrich. He's going to have me fired. Or maybe Angus McFadden. Or Megan Walpert at Spyglass. Or someone at the studio. Or the network. The result, I don't trust anyone. There's a point in the season, usually halfway through, when everyone, cast, crew, executives, everyone starts to feel like they're losing it, especially when a show is new. Tempers get short, emotions get strained. Suddenly, it's not fun anymore. I was starting to get extremely resentful of the studio and network notes we were getting. We were producing a very high-quality show, but the studio and the network didn't like it. Their biggest complaint involved what they would refer to as, quote, stakes. They felt we had too many episodes where the conflict was entirely emotional. In other words, could we have some more dead bodies? This wasn't a request. It was an order. So to get out in front of it, David and I broke a handful of episodes in which the supernatural phenomenon was sinister and dangerous enough to kill people. At first, we hated the idea. But once we got going, we were pretty happy with the results. The stories were still character-based and emotional, but now they were also more suspenseful and exciting. Maybe we did their notes too well, because the network got so excited, they decided to change the running order of the episodes, front-loading the season with the bloodier ones. This caused problems. We weren't a very serialized show, but still, the reordering of episodes resulted in a ton of small changes that had to be made throughout almost every episode. And this increased our stress and workload right at the point where we were at our lowest ebb. It affected everyone. Cast, crew, post-production, but mostly me and David. And at that point for me, the partnership with David that had been so fun and productive began to feel strained and contentious. We had our first fight, which was really David yelling at me for making some decisions without consulting him, which I should not have done. And then me quietly resenting him rather than face the conflict head on. Cracks were beginning to show in our partnership, and others could feel it. Never a good thing. A certain detachment grew between us. Nothing hostile, we just weren't as friendly as we used to be. Obviously, I can't speak for David. I just remember that during this time, the process of working on the show felt different. Not 180 degrees, not night and day, just if the previous summer had been a bright sunny afternoon, now clouds were moving in. There was a feeling of encroaching darkness. And that was also a theme in the show, which didn't help. From the session. This is really hard stuff because I have to tell you, it has the feeling of a warning. I don't want you to freak out, but it reminds me of talking to people and saying, you've got a pain in your stomach. And then the lady goes and checks and she's got a tumor. The darkness is total now. There is not a single aspect of my life that isn't under attack. I just want this session to end. From the session. I want to apologize to you, Richard, because I really wish I could sit here and say everything is going to be rosy, but this has a much more serious tone than I would like it to have. And I have compassion for you because I know how unsettling hearing these things can be. But I can also tell you from personal experience that if someone had told me in detail what was going to happen in my life, I would have thrown in the towel. But now, on the other side of those things, I wouldn't have it any other way. I leave the session feeling destroyed. Terrible things are going to happen to me over the course of the next 2 years. I don't know what. I don't know from which direction or from whom the fatal shot will come, but it's coming. Know that it is coming, and don't think for a second that it's not. Miracles debuted on Monday, January 27th, 2003. It underperformed. We aired sporadically over the next 2 months, often preempted due to news coverage of the American invasion of Iraq. We managed to air 6 of our 13 episodes, but our ratings continued to drop. And on April 2nd, 2003, just 9 weeks after we premiered, Miracles was canceled. And that was that. Did I fall into some deep depression? Absolutely. Was I in a turmoil of anger, regret, fear, shame, and an overwhelming sense of failure and loss? Exactamundo. Grief and dread pressed down on me, like a giant turkey vulture perched on my soul. Everything was not awesome. Julie Beischel's experiments are designed to test the accuracy of mediumship readings, and her results are impressive. It's important work, and there's never enough funding. But if you'd like to learn more about it, and even how you can help, check out the Windbridge Research Center at windbridge.org, and there'll be a link to it in our show notes. The work that Dr. Beischel discusses in her book, Investigating Mediums, centers on the messages mediums receive from the dead. She doesn't really talk much about the accuracy of psychic readings, or whether or not spirit guides are a thing, or are they accurate, or should we even listen to them? The disturbing messages I was given were from my spirit guides, and the ultimate message was, the next 2 years are going to be difficult. And they were. So yeah, in a way, the spirits were correct. But why couldn't they have articulated exactly what challenges I would face, what issues I'd have to grapple with, and give me advice about how I should do it? Didn't they know they were freaking me out? From the session: the important thing for you to realize is that you're not alone, that things have been constructed for you this way, for your benefit, to make you realize you're not alone. Okay, maybe their purpose was benevolent, but that's not how it felt. And if they're my spirit guides, shouldn't they have known how I was going to react to all this? They know about how I handle business and what I do in bed. Shouldn't they have seen this coming? And maybe this is why I no longer visit mediums. The sense that things are being constructed for me, the idea that someone else's hands are also on the wheel, that may very well be the case, but it doesn't make me feel good. And even worse, it makes me feel out of control, helpless. And feeling helpless, that's what I've been struggling against my entire life. When I was 36, I wanted to know the future, mainly because I had so much writing on it and so much hope that it would be better than the past. Now I'm 58, and I've mostly lived the future I had hoped for, and it's been mostly good. As each day goes by, my past keeps getting better and better. More good days pile up on top of the bad. To my spirit guides, if you're still with me, serving your eternal sentence, I'm sorry, guys. I have not grown more hard-headed in my business practices. If anything, I've become even less strategic and calculated about my career over the past 20 years. And that has turned out to be the best decision of my life. My finances are shit, but the thousands of days in the various writers' rooms that have made up the majority of my professional life have been full of creativity and laughter and friendship and free lunches. I even ended up working with David Greenwalt again when he hired me to work on his new show, Grimm. As far as my physical body is concerned, I am happy to report that I am more athletic and grounded than ever, but my frequent bike accidents have all been because my head has been in the clouds. And spirit guides, I've even tried to take your advice and focus on my lovemaking, but I assume you've seen the results considering you're always standing there right behind me. I hope whatever it is I'm doing is good enough for you. If it isn't, just avert your eyes. It'll be over soon. Yes, my life has gotten better. In fact, I would say it's become everything I ever wanted it to be. Maybe that was because of what I did, ideas I had, decisions I made. Or maybe it was you all along, constructing things. And maybe my dead relatives had a hand in it all too. I don't know. Doesn't matter. Better for me not to know. Not now. Not while life is still being lived. I do not need or want to know what is coming, or about the matrix within which I am held by unseen beings, benevolent guides, and the dearly departed, who loved me when they were alive and love me still. To do whatever it is I need to do here, to make this time through have any meaning at all, I need to believe that there are only two hands on the wheel: a bright, cloudless sky above me, a clear, open road ahead, and maybe a song on the radio that I love, something I can sing to, and not have to worry that anyone, living or dead, is around to hear. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Please join us next time for the final episode of Season 2 as we enter the absolutely mind-blowing world of the shared death experience in Glimpses of Eternity by Dr. Raymond Moody Jr. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.
Military veterans and active duty service members, you could become a certified cyber warrior with just 12 weeks of training at My Computer Career. Cybersecurity specialists are in high demand, and IT pros with these skills often enjoy abundant opportunity and a great lifestyle. Protect our people, liberty, and treasured institutions from cyber threats. SkillBridge and other VA benefits are available to those who qualify. Learn more at mycomputercareer.edu/CWP. That's mycomputercareer.edu/CWP.